Now, as Tom indicated, the initial text for this problem comes from the first edition of Bill James' Historical Abstract in 1988, when he wrote that Mantel, in the mid-60s and then in the mid-50s and then in the early 60s, was clearly greater than Mays and that it wasn't close. And in making that argument at great length and with typical vigor, he pointed out that Mantel had much higher on base percentage and that he created a good many more runs while making fewer outs, all of which is true. On defense, he acknowledged that Mays may have been a greater center fielder, but relying mainly on contemporary opinion, he argued that Mantel must have been a very good center fielder because everybody thought he was, and that therefore the difference in their defense could not possibly have been great enough to account for the difference of their offense. Now, when Bill revised the historical abstract in 2001, he narrowed the difference considerably between the two. By this time, he developed win shares, and he stated again that Mantel's three best seasons, which he identified correctly as 56, 57, and 61, were still better than Mays' best season in 65. And here is the specific data from which he drew that conclusion. Now, I am undoubtedly standing here because of Bill James. I'm sure I'm not the only person who's in this room because of Bill James. He has enriched my life a great deal, but Bill has acknowledged that many of the early conclusions he drew have had to be revised by greater evidence, and I am hoping to persuade you that the same is true of this one. And I'm doing this by measuring it in a different way. Now, the metric I'm using is wins above average. I like wins above average much more than wins above replacement for two reasons. The first is that you can measure league average very precisely, whereas replacement I don't think can be measured precisely at all. The second reason I like it better is that it gives you a much quicker, better indication of the impact the guy had on his team fortunes and how much he did or did not do to help them win the pennant. And the basic wins above average data I take on offense is from baseballreference.com. But the total numbers I'm going to give you are different from the numbers of baseballreference.com for two reasons. First of all, they use position adjustments, which I think just confuse the issue and certainly confuse the issue in a case like this because they would alter Mickey and Willie's numbers based on how the other center fielders in their leagues did in that year relative to other players, which really isn't very important. But the second major change I made was to not use their fielding data and instead to use the fielding data from Wizardry by Michael Humphreys in an extraordinary book that appeared a few years ago and that Dick Kramer, who was here, originally pointed out to me and that I want to point out to all of you. Now, what Michael Humphreys did for all positions, actually, was to take, for outfielders, we'll stick with outfielders since that's what we're doing, take putouts and assists as a ratio of balls in play, but for each team, he would adjust balls on play using regression analyses that looked at ground ball, fly ball tendencies of pitching staffs, that also looked at the number of left and right-handed batters faced. That isn't very important for center fielders, but it's very important for everybody else. He developed an extraordinary set of results. His book is quite long. It's very well written. He does compare his method to every other major fielding method. And best of all, he had it published by Oxford University Press, and they put all his results from 1901 to, I think, about 2008. Spreadsheets which you can download from the Oxford University Press website for free. They're very easy to sort, very easy to use, and they may be made to do this study. And with respect to Mickey and Willie, they changed the results dramatically. So here we have my data on the best seasons of these players based on Humphrey's fielding numbers, the offensive numbers from baseballreference.com. No position adjustments. Now, I would focus on the WAA category in the middle. If you start adding up runs, you're going to drive yourself crazy. One reason is that the question of exactly how many runs above average makes a win above average is season and league dependent. So it's not going to look like it makes sense. But believe me, these are accurate. And what we see here, in our first pass of the data, is that in fact, contrary to what sports writers at the time thought, Willie was massively superior to Mickey in the field. Mickey, in fact, was quite average in the field, and indeed, these are three of his better seasons in the field, and he declined quite a bit later on. And that therefore, the statement that Mickey is a measurably very greater player than Mays at his peak appears to be invalidated. He is still a little greater in their very best seasons, 1957 for Mickey, when he had an on-base average of over 500, and 1954 for Willie, when he was the batting title, won the batting title. Then he's about half a win better in the next two. Now, it's only fair to use that fourth season of Willie's, because the 64 and 65 seasons are so close. Mantle does not have another season in his whole career which is close to the numbers there. We'll look at this later. But his next best season actually is about a flat 7 wins above average. So at this point, based on Willie's fielding skill, we have narrowed this. But I'm not going to stop there, and I've got plenty of time, and I'm going to use some of the time to introduce some additional questions about, first of all, to introduce an additional question about evaluating fielding among outfielders, which was suggested by Humphrey's data. And the issue is, if you've got an outfielder with really good or bad numbers, is he getting those really good or bad numbers partly because of what the other outfielders are doing? And this is the rather striking example that got Michael Humphrey, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, he lives in California, thinking about this, that he found that Joe DiMaggio in 1947, when he was coming off the first field operation, had these absolutely terrible numbers in center field. But then he looks at Lindell, Henrik, and Keller in left and right field, and he found that they had extraordinarily good numbers. And that, in fact, the whole Yankee outfield was a tiny bit above average for 1947. So he concluded, reasonably, that they all knew that Joe D had lost a few steps because of his operation, and that, contrary to the normal procedure when the center fielder takes everything, they were going to take everything they could and cut down on his work, and apparently that's what they did. So I thought I would look at the Mays and Mantle data to see if anything jumped out that suggested that any of their numbers might be misleading. And here's what we have. Now, looking at Willie, it turns out that in 54 and 58, well, in 54, the whole giant outfield was superb. Monty Irvin playing a major role. Right field was a little below average, but still, it looks as if Mays' 30 runs saved do represent superior skill. The same appears to be true in 1958, when the rest of the outfield was perfectly average. But in 1964 and 1965, it turns out Willie was surrounded by a large number of mediocre or worse corner outfielders, including people like Orlando Cepeda and Linda Covey and Harvey Keene and Cap Peterson and Len Gabrielson. So they were below average. So if possible, one could hypothesize that some of those extra outs he made that turned into runs, remember, it takes, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's somewhere around 2 fly balls, maybe, according to Humphreys, he works that out in great detail, to make a run, 2 outs to make a run. Some of those, possibly, were balls that were not difficult for him to catch, were balls that a normal right fielder or left fielder would have caught, and thus don't really represent superior skill for him. But I would suggest that that's probably a very minor effect. Again, this is all pretty preliminary. We just started thinking about these things, but a left or right fielder can miss a ball in any one of 4 directions. He can miss it in front of him, which I think is probably where most of them are missed, behind him, and to either side. And in only one of those cases, really, would the center fielder have a chance of catching it. So I suspect that in this case, that distortion is very minor, and Willie does deserve credit for just about all those runs saved. On the other hand, we see there's nothing particularly striking about the mammal figures in 57 or 56. The whole outfield was pretty much dead average. We do see something interesting in 1961, where the left fielders were very good, including Yogi Berra, interestingly enough, but very good numbers, whereas Roger Maris had the first of several undistinguished seasons in right field. So I don't see any reason to make any major adjustment to what we saw a couple of slides ago. Based on that, still leading Mickey somewhat ahead. But now we have another big issue to raise, which again was brought up by Michael Humphries, who's very interested in the changing strength of leagues. And he brought up the point in discussing the 50s and 60s. All his results, like all my results, and this is part of a much larger project, by the way, identifying seasons of four or more wins above average and their impact over the whole of baseball since 1901, are based on wins above average. So we have to ask, are the averages in the two leagues the same? And Michael pointed out that there's an excellent reason to suggest that the average in the American League was a good deal lower than the National League for some of this period, namely because of greater integration in the National League. And again, helped by Baseball Reference, which is easy to work with and source, I decided to look into that in a little more detail myself. So, this table shows how many wins above average were generated by African American players in either league or by black Latin players. Offensive players only. As you know, there are so few black and Latin pitchers in this era that I thought I could afford to ignore them since they wouldn't have a big impact on the average. And how does this differ? And as you can see, actually, I was a little surprised that the difference in the 50s wasn't greater. Now again, you see, we're using the seasons we're comparing. We compared Mickey in 57 to Willie in 54, their best seasons, and so on down the line. And we're comparing both 64 and 65 for Willie with 61. So the difference isn't as great as you might have thought in the first two cases, although it's there. In the early 60s, however, there's a whole generation of black superstars coming into the National League. It's not happening in the American League. And the difference becomes very significant. And so, being a historian, not a mathematician, I try to combine myself with fairly simple calculations. But I ask myself, how can I turn this into a meaningful comparison of the average in the two leagues? And the first thing I did, I want to show you this, is to subtract in each of these cases. So you have additional wins above average created by black stars in the National League, for which there is no analog in the American League. And when you take those runs and see what they did to average runs scored in the National League, this is what you see. There's a 1.5 increase in average runs scored, 2.0 in 54, 2.8 in 58, 6.3 in 64, and 7.7 in 65. And then I made what seems to me a very conservative assumption. I said, let's take away those additional black superstars rolled up in the American League, and let's replace them with average quality players. Now, that is a conservative assumption, because you could very easily argue that you couldn't find more average quality players, but I didn't want to be accused of pushing this too far, and in addition, this whole business of constructing alternate baseball universes is fairly dubious. I mean, we can't really say what would have happened if the National League, for whatever reason, had decided to remain more segregated. So I went with that assumption. We replaced them with average quality players. And that came up with an entirely new set of results. For one thing, because the impact of this was so much greater than 64 and 65, it changes the order of Willie's seasons. Now, these are my final results. and they're kind of interesting. My friend Steve Zavisky, another Yankee fan, will still be able to go to sleep tonight with their universe intact, because Mickey still does have an edge. But it is a very, very trivial edge, very much within the margin of error of any analysis like this. So, I don't have any compunction in saying, in conclusion, that using the best methods I can, it turns out that the overall value of Willie and Mickey appears to be just about identical in their best seasons. And I think you have to give Willie a little bit of an edge going back once again, because again, he has four seasons in this range while Mickey only has three. Just a couple of more things about, yes, you can read that, most of you can anyway, about exactly how great these guys work. Now, in my larger study, okay, the definition of a superstar season is four wins above average. And here we see, we see Mays with an incredible 14 seasons over four wins above average, including one when he was 40 years old, and he almost made five. We see Mickey with nine. We see that the median for Willie is considerably higher. In addition, we see this rather extraordinary record. Okay, these results are summarized in English in the next slide. And we see that 10 times Willie Mays was either the most valuable player or the most valuable offensive player, or in one case tied for the most valuable player by these measurements in the National League, whereas Mickey led the American League or led offensive players six times. This is pretty extraordinary, as indeed they were. However, one very interesting point. The best season in their generation and in their era that I identified was by Carl Yastrzemski in 1967, when he had 10 wins above average. Granted, he too was playing in a very weak league, probably weaker than any of the other leagues we've been looking at, but still, that was pretty impressive. This just about concludes what I wanted to say. We'll look forward to a few questions, but I do want to make one broader philosophical point as a sabermetrician and a historian. Ever since sophisticated sabermetrics started coming out about 30 years ago, I have been absolutely fascinated by the fact that with all the thousands and thousands of men who play professional baseball, there is this really tiny minority of people, of whom these are two, who are much, much better than anyone else. And it seems to me that's a fascinating fact about human beings, also addressed by Malcolm Gladwell in Outliers. Now, and it is my opinion, both as a historian and based on what I've seen in my own life, that is true of other areas of serious human endeavor as well. There is a tiny minority of people in almost anything you can think of who, for whatever reason, they're not much better than anybody else. The wonderful thing about baseball, whether you're a player or just a fan, is that we can identify who those people are pretty inarguably. But what my experience in life and my studies as a historian have shown me is that if you happen to be one of those outliers in a field in which there is no such clear objective measurement as there in baseball, there's no telling what's going to happen to you. And that is one of the great things about sabermetrics in baseball, that we can tell who is really great. Thank you very much, and I'll be glad to
I'm
not aware of such a study.
No. I'm just suggesting.
Right.
at the same time. And this new day is difficult. It's a very difficult one. One just observation, the 1961 measurement says that the Yankee left fielders were greatly above average, and it's Yogi Berra and Hector Lopez.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think any system that says that is suspect.
It can be. Have you read Humphrey's books?
No, I have not. There's a lot of fielders in left center field, and I can agree that those guys probably made a lot of catches out there. But, you know, I was there. They weren't that.
All right. Michael Humphries is a very careful guy, and he's not an inflammatory guy, but he had a lot of fun in the book identifying the huge mistakes that have been made in every era about who was really good and who wasn't. And since you're evidently a Yankee fan.
I'm not a Yankee.
Oh, you're not a Yankee fan. I don't want to mention the biggest and most notorious mistake, which involves somebody who's going to be unanimously elected to the whole thing in 5 years. And there's nothing that Michael Humphries, I, or anybody else wants to do about that. But to put it bluntly, Derek Jeter, who has won 5 Gold Gloves, has probably cost the team as many runs in the field as any player in the history of baseball. But there are many examples like that in every era. Now, it is true that it is possible, and I talked to somebody who works for a team about this, where they track batted balls. In one season, any outfielder can have a remarkable number of balls hit just within his reach. That can happen. But that will evidently, I mean, Michael's results are sufficiently consistent over the course of a career and show a consistent pattern. People get worse as they get older. That it looks pretty reliable. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.